proceed to the third case of the morning, Emergency Services Billing Corp. versus Allstate Insurance. Mr. Williams?
May it please the Court, my name is Joe Williams, and I'm here on behalf of the Appellants Emergency Services Billing Corporation. This appeal got to this Court by the District Court's granting of the defendant's motion for judgment on the pleadings. When the District Court granted that motion for judgment on the pleadings, it determined that the motor vehicles at issue were consumer products in consumer use under CERCLA. And in doing so, fell outside of the statutory definition of a facility. Now, when the District Court made that determination, it ignored the EPA's interpretation of that phrase, and in doing so, committed a reversible error. This morning, I hope to discuss first that the phrase consumer product is ambiguous within the context of CERCLA. Next, that the EPA recognized this ambiguity and chose to weigh in and provide its interpretation to that phrase in such a way that excludes the motor vehicles at issue in this case. Finally, I hope to discuss why the EPA's interpretation of the phrase consumer products was reasonable in light of the purposes of CERCLA. So turning first to the ambiguity of the phrase within the context of CERCLA, a statutory phrase is deemed ambiguous if it's susceptible to more than one meaning, and that description is found in the United States Supreme Court's decision Chickasaw Nation, which is referred to in our brief. The phrase consumer product was not defined anywhere in CERCLA. Now, in Title 15, the Congress enacted two acts which both dealt with that phrase consumer product.
That's, of course, a different statutory scheme.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I missed your question.
That's a different statutory scheme. That's not part of CERCLA.
I agree with Your Honor.
So we don't look to a wholly different statutory scheme to create ambiguity where there is none otherwise. I mean, the face of the phrase consumer product is not ambiguous as it appears in CERCLA itself.
Okay, if I understand.
As I understand your argument, it's to create ambiguity by looking to the Consumer Product Safety Act definition and the Magnuson-Moss Act definitions.
If I understand Your Honor's question correctly, it's that the plain meaning of consumer product would encompass a motor vehicle.
Right. And so we don't have to look elsewhere.
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor, and I think this issue was raised or dealt with by the United States Supreme Court in the Robinson case, which is referred to in our reply brief at pages 6 and 7. In the Robinson case, the Supreme Court was confronted with Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, which stated that it was unlawful for, quote, an employer to discriminate against any of his employees, end quote, for making use of Title VII. The petitioner in that case argued that that phrase should include former employees. When we look at the plain meaning of the phrase his employees, I think it's clear that the plain meaning of that phrase would exclude former employees. It speaks of employees in the current. And Justice Thomas, when he was writing for the majority in that case, recognized that on its face that phrase appears to exclude former employees. But in looking at the statute in that case, the Civil Rights Act, and looking at the purposes of the act, the court held that it does include former employees despite the fact that the plain meaning of that phrase would dictate otherwise. And I think that's what we're looking at here.
Did that case go outside Title VII in search of ambiguity?
That case did not go outside of Title VII in search for ambiguity.
That's what you're asking us to do here, is to go outside of CERCLA in search of a basis for finding an otherwise plain phrase in the statute to be ambiguous.
Well, we've got in 9601, where Congress defined facility. It defined facility to include, in subsection 9601-9A, any building structure, et cetera, and motor vehicle, any motor vehicle. Then in subsection B, it says, but this does not include any consumer product in consumer use. We've got two things. We've got the statement that any motor vehicle is a facility. We've got the statement that there's no consumer product that falls within that definition. I think that alone begins to demonstrate that there is, you know, there is some ambiguity here.
I don't think so. A primary definition includes motor vehicles, but then in subsection B exempts consumer products, which means that motor vehicles that are not consumer products are included, but motor vehicles that are consumer products, in other words, used by individuals or in ordinary household use, you know, according to the Black's Law Dictionary definition of consumer product, are excluded. And that seems to be all we need to decide this case. We don't have to look any further, and we certainly don't have to look to different statutory schemes.
Well, Your Honor, I think I understand Your Honor's point that we should stay within the confines of CERCLA. And the reason I'm looking to these other statutes is because the law determines a phrase or term to be ambiguous if it's susceptible to more than one meaning. Congress itself has stated that this term is susceptible to more than one meaning.
In different statutes.
Well, Your Honor, we don't have a definition of consumer product within CERCLA.
Right, we use the dictionary definition unless for some reason, you know, there's some vagueness or ambiguity in that or in this particular application that would require us to go elsewhere.
I think it
seems to me there just isn't. The cars in question in this case were personal vehicles being used for personal household use and therefore fit the ordinary definition or ordinary meaning of consumer product.
I think Your Honor understands my argument, and I believe I'm going to, if it's okay with the court, I will move on. Notwithstanding the fact that we have argued that the phrase is ambiguous for the reasons set forth in the brief and the reasons I've just discussed, Congress was also silent on that issue. And there have been a number of courts, including, I believe, the Grand Canyon case, which was cited in our brief by the D.C. Circuit, that says when Congress is silent with regard to a key term in a statute, that silence is an implicit delegation of authority to the executive agency that's charged with the administration of the statute, which here with CERCLA would be the EPA. Now, I understand that Your Honor has said that we shouldn't look outside of CERCLA, but here Congress was silent on this key term, and by doing so delegated authority implicitly to the EPA to interpret that term. And in light of the ambiguity and the congressional silence, it was reversible error for the district court not to look to the EPA's interpretation. So let me turn to the EPA's interpretation of the phrase in question. I think recognizing the silence and the ambiguity that we pointed out in our brief, the EPA chose to weigh in on this issue. And in 40 CFR 3025, the EPA said consumer product within the context of CERCLA, quote, shall have the meaning in 15 U.S.C. 2052. And 2052, which is the Consumer Product Safety Act, Congress defined consumer product using first the general term, the general definition that Judge Sykes was referring to, but separated by a semicolon says, but such term does not include motor vehicles. Now, the district court recognized that the EPA promulgated that regulation, and it even stated that it owed some deference to the EPA's determination. But the district court chose to read the exclusion, that motor vehicle exclusion, out. And that happened on both pages 17 and 18 of the appendix and page 7 and 8 of the supplemental appendix. There's several reasons that it was error for the district court to read out that motor vehicle exception from the Consumer Product Safety Act definition. The EPA was confronted with two statutes enacted by Congress that dealt with the definition of consumer product, the Consumer Product Safety Act and the Magnuson-Moss Warranty Act. The CPSA has language that specifically excludes motor vehicles from the definition. The Magnuson-Moss Warranty Act does not. The EPA, with knowledge of both of those statutes, elected to adopt the interpretation or the definition that Congress provided in the CPSA. if the EPA had desired to retain motor vehicles or qualify a motor vehicle, personal motor vehicle, as a consumer product, it could have adopted the definition, the congressional definition in the Magnuson-Moss Act. It did not. And another reason that it was error to read that exclusion out, that motor vehicle exclusion out, is seen when we look at the proposed rule that that the EPA put out in 1983 and the final rule that was actually adopted in 85. In the proposed rule, which is both referenced by the appellees in their brief and the district court in its decision, speaks only of the general definition. It doesn't mention anything about the motor vehicle exclusion. But 2 years later, when the EPA adopted its regulation, it didn't adopt the final rule, or it didn't adopt the proposed rule. What it did was say it shall have the meaning in 2052. If the EPA, again, had desired to read out that motor vehicle exclusion that the district court and the appellees choose to do, then it could have just adopted its proposed rule, but it did not.
Now, this is an argument that the district court raised sua sponte, as I understand the record. You didn't argue the EPA's approach to this in the district court. Is that right?
Your Honor, I believe specifically no, impliedly yes. And I think this is addressed by the Bailey decision that I discussed in my reply brief in response to the appellee's waiver argument. I'm going to address this briefly, but then I would like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal. In front of the district court, the ESBC did argue that the court should look to 2052, the CPSA definition, which includes the motor vehicle exception. That's the same definition that was adopted by the EPA. It may have been inartful to use the language of the Bailey decision, but I think it was certainly preserved for review.
And with you that, raised that in what, motion to reconsider?
It was first raised, Your Honor, in response to the motion for judgment on the pleadings. The actual specific reference to the EPA regulation was made in the motion to reconsider. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Sure, Mr. Williams. Thank you. Mr. Girth.
My name is Mark Girth. I'm from Keitlinger and Gray in Indianapolis, and I represent State Farm in this litigation, but I will be arguing on behalf of all of the appellees. The district court in this case held that the language, consumer products in consumer use, is unambiguous and means personal property used for personal, family, or household purposes. And based upon that clear and unambiguous language, it concluded that the individual defendants who are operating private passenger cars for personal reasons were operating consumer products in consumer use, and that therefore they were not subject to the provisions of CERCLA. As Judge Sykes has observed, really there's no need to go any further. The basic rule of statutory construction is to give the statute and the words contained therein their plain and ordinary meaning. For the first time on appeal, ESBC tries to argue that there's some ambiguity in this language. But the rule is, to make a determination of ambiguity, you look at the statute itself and the words used to determine whether those words are plain and ambiguous. You do not go beyond the statute to determine whether there is an ambiguity. When do you have an ambiguity? When reasonable people could find that the statutory language is subject to more than one interpretation. ESBC, not at the trial court, in response to the motion for judgment on the pleadings, not in its motion for reconsideration, not in its appellant's brief or in its reply brief, has offered any reasonable interpretation in ordinary language which would lead anyone to conclude that consumer products does not include private passenger automobiles. They run off to a statute adopted for completely different purposes, but they have never got up and said, this does not include automobiles because. They have never offered any alternate interpretation of this statute other than the one that's set out in the Consumer Product Safety Act. And the reason why the definition in that act can't control here is because there is a clear and obvious reason as to why motor vehicles were excluded from the definition in the Consumer Product Safety Act. And that's because there was a separate existing federal statute addressing safety standards for motor vehicles.
That's true of every single one of the exceptions to the definition of consumer product in the Consumer Product Safety Act, as I understand it. And so it appears as though all of those exceptions or exclusions from the term in that statutory scheme exist to prevent any conflict between the two statutory schemes. In other words, the general one that applies to consumer products and the more specific ones that apply to motor vehicles, tobacco, pesticides, etc.
Yes, I agree wholeheartedly, Your Honor. And in fact, because Congress felt compelled to enact these various exceptions from the definition of motor vehicle in the Consumer Product Safety Act, we can reasonably infer that Congress assumed that unless those exceptions were enacted, all of those various products would fall within the ordinary accepted meaning of a consumer product.
So what's up with the EPA?
What's up in the EPA, with the EPA is we have some ambiguous regulatory language. when the EPA proposed the rule, they only referenced the general definitional language. They then subsequently formally enacted the regulation and referred to the whole statute. We have no idea why.
Nobody noticed this during the entire notice and comment period?
Apparently not. I would note that if the plaintiff's argument is to be accepted, everybody who's in an automobile accident in the United States is subject to EPA notification and liability.
Right. It's pretty extraordinary.
And I haven't seen any cites to any administrative actions or any suits brought by the EPA against people in automobile accidents seeking recovery.
Has this ever happened before where, to your knowledge, that a municipality is trying to shift the cost of accident response to and hazardous materials or hazardous releases response to the automobile owner's insurer?
Yes, Your Honor. This actually is a quite active area of legislation and at both the local level, the state level, and if we accept plaintiff's argument, at the federal level.
Legislation or litigation? Or both?
Well, I'm presently involved on behalf of State Farm in a dispute over the interpretation of an ordinance in Crown Point as to whether drivers in automobiles are subject under a Crown Point ordinance to pay this type of response. As referenced in the amicus brief, there are Indiana state statutes which provide for the recovery of responders' costs by volunteer and regular fire departments. So this is not a this is not a unique case, but I think the attempt of the plaintiffs to, in essence, federalize this whole area is not well taken in light of the clear language of the statute, which exempts ordinary consumers.
But there isn't any appellate case on this definition, though, as applied to personal automobiles.
No, we're only very early on in the litigation. I think we'll see a lot of it at the local and state level in the next few years, but nothing has made it up to the Court of Appeals
so these,
yet.
So these local ordinances are of fairly recent vintage, to your knowledge?
Yes, Your Honor, within the last 10 years or so, and I think there's been, well, let's face it, with the economic problems and local municipalities and townships are looking for other sources of income, and this is one. And with all due respect, I think these cases have a lot less to do with preventing pollution and cleaning up pollution and a lot more to do with generating income for fire departments.
Or shifting the cost, not necessarily generating income because it's going to zero out, but it's a different insurance base.
Sure. But there's absolutely, we don't know what the coverage implications are yet. In this particular case, for example, the allegation is that there's a claim for charges for simply responding to the emergency and making sure that there was no hazardous spill. Mm-hmm. There's a significant question as to whether that would even be covered under a liability policy.
As auto insurers aren't in the general business of underwriting for these sorts of risks, right?
Not generally. For instance, State Farm, as mentioned in the briefs, does have a minimal coverage under its collision coverage for debris removal, but that's only $250. And these bills are routinely in the range of $1,500 to
$2,500. Garth, with the rise of hybrid vehicles, has that affected the industry on the question of hazardous? Because I understand that first responders have a special responsibility or an additional responsibility connected with collisions involving hybrids.
You've touched a subject that I've never heard of before, Your Honor, and I'd be hard-pressed to really express an opinion.
Discussing policy for a second, whether or not having to disconnect.
The position seems to be that if they just simply go out there, they've incurred costs and they're entitled to recover them, and whether dealing with battery acid spillage.
Well, there's fuel left in a fuel tank. Is that a potential hazard, I suppose?
It certainly is. Well, one could foresee a situation where it could prove to be a hazard. I don't want to say that every time you have an accident, you have a potential hazard. It depends on each instance in each case. But again, most of these cases do not involve significant spillage. You might have a little bit of antifreeze on the ground, or occasionally leakage of gasoline. But I think not only did Congress not want to impose these costs upon the ordinary consumer, I think there was at least some thought that these did not represent major environmental hazards. Most automobiles hold less than 25 gallons of gasoline, and even less oil and antifreeze and other fluids. So I think the point was, one, we don't want to impose this substantial liability for reporting and paying on the ordinary consumer. and that, generally speaking, consumer products don't represent a significant exposure to cause hazardous material emergencies. You're talking about relatively minor amounts of fuel, and I think when you read the comments of the sponsors of the legislation, the very broad language of the exclusion, which excludes any consumer product in consumer use, the clear clear import and the clear thought behind Congress's actions here was not to create a method for fire departments to shift their costs onto the ordinary consumer. And for that reason, among a myriad of others, the district court clearly did not err when it determined that CERCLA does not apply to personal automobiles because they're consumer products and consumer use.
Thank you, Mr. Girth. Mr. Williams?
The final rule of the EPA was adopted in 1985, and that's when the EPA said consumer products shall mean 15 U.S.C. 2052. In 1986, Congress amended CERCLA. They did nothing to change. They did nothing to add a definition. So, following up on Judge Sykes' comment that, you know, nobody caught this in the 2 years for comment, we could assume that nobody either caught it when Congress chose to amend the statute or that Congress tacitly approved of it. I'm troubled by one point that was discussed in that because there was a dictionary definition, because there was a plain definition of consumer product, the phrase can't be ambiguous. I think this is mentioned in our reply brief, but that type of argument lends itself to say nothing can ever be ambiguous because all words have a dictionary definition, and usually the words we're using in court proceedings have a Black's Law dictionary definition as well. But the determination of ambiguity is made if it's susceptible to more than one interpretation. And
what's the other interpretation that you're offering?
The other interpretation is the other interpretation that Congress provided in the Consumer Product Safety Act.
No, that's not sufficient. What is it about the phrase consumer product and consumer use that doesn't cover motor vehicles used by individuals for their personal use or household use?
I understand Your Honor's question, but respectfully, our position is that when Congress enacted the Consumer Product Safety Act, it made the determination, with that and the Magnuson-Moss Act, it made the determination, it decided that this phrase is susceptible to more than one meaning. And in the appellee's...
What it did in the Consumer Product Safety Act is define consumer products very broadly and then carved out a number of exemptions for existing consumer products that were already subject to pervasive regulatory schemes, including motor vehicles. That carve-out had an obvious purpose, which was to make sure there was no conflict between the two regulatory schemes. That just doesn't apply here.
And the EPA could have adopted the Magnuson-Moss Warranty Act when it found its when it decided to interpret consumer product, but it
didn't.
I don't
know why the EPA did what it did, but we only get there if there is facial ambiguity or some sort of vagueness in application on the facts here. And I don't see either. There certainly isn't facial ambiguity. The phrase consumer product and consumer use is susceptible of an ordinary meaning, and I don't see any particular vagueness in the application that is at issue here, which is to say whether personal automobiles are consumer products. And you haven't offered one. You just keep repairing to the EPA rule.
I see that my time is up. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. Thanks to all counsel. Your case is taken under advisement.